This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Now, let me introduce you to the first speaker in our session, which is really now looking at where does the Melbourne Cup belong in Australian culture and why has it endured? We have three terrific historians or people who've made a real speciality of understanding the history of the Melbourne Cup. And Dr. Chris McConville is going to speak first. He is an expert in the history of gambling in Australia and has always been interested in the underside of Australian life. In fact, he was just saying that it seems whenever anyone wants something written about the criminal underside of Australia, he seems to be the one they ask. So he's obviously got a reputation of some kind. And Melbourne, of course, in particular, is an area that he's very knowledgeable about. He was a joint editor of the influential book Outcasts of Melbourne. He's also been researching the life and career of that much-debated figure in Australian sport, politics and gambling, John Wren. He's a social historian and has written on working life, labour history in Australia, and he's also written on the internationalisation of the Caulfield and Melbourne Cups. Please welcome Chris McConville.
Thanks, Louise. Thanks for that introduction. And distinguished guests and punters, one and all. I'm going to be talking about the topic I was given was Melbourne Cup, is it just a gamble? And that's a bit of a Dorothy Dixer of a question because we know it is a gamble, but it's not just a gamble. And it's a relief to come to Canberra this week, actually, for this gathering, to get away from Collingwood supporters driving out the odds on Geelong for the AFL Grand Final and people driving in the odds of Japanese horses on the Melbourne Cup, and to get away from that excitement and come to the lassitude of an even money electoral contest in which what used to be called stable whispers but are now called leaks have meant that the odds have moved around so much you can happily back both major political parties in this election campaign and come out ahead. Which is the aim, the dream of all punters to do that sort of thing. So I'm going to talk about the role of gambling in the Melbourne Cup just quickly and to come back to something Andrew Peacock said earlier about if you think four equals four or four adds up to four, you're in the wrong place dealing with horse racing. And most gamblers have found out that to their cost that you might dream about finding the winner of the Melbourne Cup, as Banjo Patterson said, but the bookmakers know that four equals four. And the horses that have fascinated me since I was young in the Melbourne Cup aren't the pantheon of champions that Les Carline talked about. They're horses like the Pearl that won in 1871, Andrew, at 100-1, and Old Rowley in 1940 at 100-1, and Wotan at 1936 at 100-1. And I've always thought that since the Melbourne Cup's been going for 150 years and three horses at 100-1 have actually won the race in 150 years, it ought to be very easy to put money on long shots and come out ahead. Until I actually looked at the entire betting markets for the Cup going back to 1861, and you would have come out a long way behind if you'd backed every horse that started at 100-1 in every Melbourne Cup. In some years there are about eight horses starting at odds at 101 and over. But if you had started with the Pearl in 1871 and gone through to Old Rowley in 1940 and been smart enough not to bet when Farlap and Peter Pan were running in the Cup, and you managed to up your investment, as punters euphemistically like to call throwing money away, up your investment in the early 1980s when the crowds went up in the at Flemington, you would have been able to get Zulu at 50-1 in 1881 and the Assyrian in 1882 at 33-1 and Malura at 20-1 in 1884 and then through to Tarcoola at about 40-1 in 1891. And if you'd kept that going, I had a bit of a break in the 1950s and come back in the 1970s when John Letts was riding Piping Lane, you would have got another winner at 40-1. And if you'd followed Bart Cummings' horses and gone easy on some of the short-priced ones, you would have got viewed at 40-1 a few years ago. And I notice that one of his horses is listed at the moment at 200-1 for this year's Cup, so it's probably worth an investment. So the Melbourne Cup is about gambling, and it is about this dreaming of beating the odds and making a fortune from minimal effort. But it's also about participating in what gambling is, in which it's a collective activity that produces some sort of market on an event that lasts for a few minutes. It's probably not true, though, that gambling has always had a central place in the Cup from the 1860s onwards. I mean, we know that there's an enormous amount of money changes hands through corporate bookmakers and through the TAB and in on-course bookmakers and various other locations around Australian cities in the Melbourne Cup now. The Productivity Commission data from last year's Melbourne Cup listed on Australian TABs on the Cup itself, 150 million bet, 40 million of that in Victoria, and on the Cup Day races, $223 million invested and 72 million in Victoria. So there's a vast amount of money changing hands. Obviously, some of it's being bet a couple of times, people laying off bets, etc. But it's a huge amount of money changing hands, of which the TABs take out about, you know, 13, 14, 15%, depending on the bets. The early Melbourne Cup, though, didn't have this emphasis on gambling. Probably only 6 to 10 bookmakers fielded in some years, and the bookmakers who did operate on the Melbourne Cup were actually making a book, walking around with a pocketbook, taking bets, usually on doubles betting. So it's a much more favourable arrangement for the bookmakers, I guess, especially with all-in betting than for the punters. And the Melbourne Cup, of course, is run before the introduction of free and compulsory education in Victoria. So the grasp that most punters had of the probabilities of a 100-to-1 horse winning is probably a lot less than people who go to summer schools nowadays might have. The massive wins that we saw in the 1880s occurred at the time after the registration of bookmaking, in which bookmakers actually did stand up on stands headed by Robert Sevier, call out the odds and put them up on a board so that the betting became more transparent, and came after a decade in which bookmakers had had a negative effect on Australian racing and the Melbourne Cup in particular, and were seen as quite inimical to the success of racing. They weren't seen as part of any romance of racing in the way that we might see with the betting ring nowadays. And there's good reasons for the bookmakers being held in pretty low esteem in the 1870s. Apologies to anybody now who's engaged in the industry, but there was a boatload of horses coming to one of the Melbourne Cups in the spring carnivals in the 1870s on a boat called the City of Melbourne, under the command of Captain Paddle, and the boat ran aground, and out of the 11 horses, I think only 2 survived. And the bookmakers of Melbourne immediately donated Captain Paddle a bag of sovereigns for his contribution to their profits over the spring carnival. Another famous horse of the year at Newminster was found poisoned in its stable, and the trainer had previously seen one of the stable boys talking to a bookmaker. There was an incident in which bookmakers are supposed to have paid somebody to block the Geelong train line to prevent horses getting to the spring carnival. So the 1870s is a time in which bookmaking seemed to be semi-criminal activity, uncontrolled by racing clubs, and it's really only after the VRC registered bookmakers in the 1880s, 1882, and then introduced stipendiary stewards in 1912, that some of that chicanery around racing and the manipulation of people who wanted to bet came to an end, but it was at least brought under some sort of control. The other, of course, side of gambling that we probably more familiar with nowadays is betting on the TAB, an invention by George Julius, who grew up in New Zealand. His father was actually an archbishop of in the South Island of New Zealand and was a leading anti-gambling crusader. And Julius's tote, and I think there's one in the Powerhouse Museum, a part of his original mechanical tote. It was set up at on the first floor in that big brick building at Eagle Farm Racecourse not so long ago. Julius originally decided he'd invent a voting machine, and it turned out that people who ran elections who he was trying to promote this to were probably far less honest than the bookmakers, so it became a gambling device. Used the first time at Flemington in Farlap's 1931 Melbourne Cup. The TAB, of course, has gone on to be the major form of gambling around Australia. introduced as a public benefit in Victoria when the first TAB opened in Melbourne in 1961, the same weekend as Monash University opened its doors. Henry Bolte announced that Victorians would never have to pay any money towards public hospitals ever again. So beyond bookmakers and the TAB now, we have this enormous opportunities for gambling. As I say, we can bet on elections. And I think, I said it was an even money bet now. I think if you equalise all of the corporate betting agencies and reduce their margins to 100% book, it's about 66% to the Labor Party now and 33% to the Liberal Party. So unless the former Prime Minister turned cub reporter gets on the stage next week, there's probably still some money to be made on that election. Each Australian state now has a casino. Poker machines are now in those states, almost all the parts of Australia which resisted poker machines in the past. Betting on football matches used to be a sort of on-the-side activity, something that was not spoken about and publicised, but you can't even see the teams on television now without seeing the betting odds underneath them. And so the notion that horse racing has this monopoly on gambling and the essence of going to the races and participating in horse racing as a spectacle and as a great event is no longer so tied directly to gambling and the opportunities to gamble as it once was. But I think there's still something about the betting ring and betting on horses as against betting on football players or politicians that does have a certain romance about it. The horses are better looking than most of the politicians, present company excepted. The bookmakers themselves, once they became registered, were part of the carnival of the racecourse and part of the theatre of going to the races. So bookmakers like Sol Green, who'd come to Australia as a Jewish boy from the East End of London, would stand up dressed in the dark blue and the light blue of Oxford and Cambridge on his betting stand. Other bookmakers stood up dressed in sailors' costumes. The betting ring initially was not this sort of hard-nosed, you know, on-the-spot calculation about odds and percentages. It was much more a theatrical performance event, and the character of racing and the race itself really is part of the attraction of going to the races. It's also this participation in this the theatre of the betting ring, with its whole range of characters from wealthy owners, tight-mouthed trainers, down to the coat tuggers and the fully criminal element who participate in the betting ring, and their connection with this vast unknown economy that existed in Australia until quite recently of SP betting. And there's been a number of inquiries into SP betting in Australia, all of which come up with vastly differing amounts of how much money went through the SP market in pubs and then in flats and down back lanes of Australian cities and country towns. I think it was Tommy Smith who said you could put $10,000 on an SP in Sydney on a Saturday morning and the odds wouldn't move, so that's some indication of the enormity of the amount of money that went through off-track SP betting until the introduction of TABs, and something that, you know, generally accepted as a normal part of Australian life. One of those famous Sydney colourful characters who appeared in Underbelly wrote an autobiography in which he said, taking up SP betting rescued me from a life of crime, which is probably a fairly accurate indication of how Australians thought about SP betting. So betting itself is much more than just this mechanical percentage-based, hard-nosed numerical calculation of horses' odds. Despite the fact that in the long run that is what it's about, we all see betting on horses and especially on the Melbourne Cup as something to do with chasing the dream. And if we chase it too hard, we start to focus on these 100, get obsessed, as I've done many years, get obsessed with these 100-to-1 shots. But if we focus on the favourites, we don't do all that well out of the Melbourne Cup either, I don't think, in the long term. Much lower percentages of favourites winning than a lot of other major races, but then again, because of the size of the fields and the amount of money put on the horses, the odds on the favourite are generally quite a bit longer than they are on most other feature races. And I suppose one of the things about the role of gambling in the Melbourne Cup is that some of that drama and colour and excitement of the betting ring has been lost as people have turned to the TAB. And it's probably been lost from the other side as well, in that punters themselves have turned to computerised analysis of form, etc., rather than looking at the horses, talking to the stables, following rumours, following the market, understanding what went on the training track, as did some of those sort of legendary punters of the interwar years in the 1950s, Eric Conley, Frank Duval, known as the Hong Kong Tiger because of his Asian steel investments by the sporting press. His Asian steel investments were in Japan, not Hong Kong, but the sporting press didn't worry too much about the distinction. A lot of that sort of mythology of the betting ring, I think, has been lost. You know, it has become, from the point of view of the people providing the opportunity to bet, a much more sort of technical activity, and from the point of view of the gambler or the punter, a much more technical computer-based activity. When computers started being used first in gambling, a British historian wrote a book, The Computer, The Revenge of the Punter. But I don't think it's turned out like that. It's actually provided more information and spread out the knowledge on horse racing to people who otherwise wouldn't have the knowledge, and it's taken away our opportunity to get ahead of the pack and identify the 101 chance that really should be 20 to 1. At least that's what we like to think we thought to do. It's probably 101 chance, 100 to 1 chance, it should have been an 80 to 1 chance. So gambling is part of the cup. It has produced these colourful interchanges in the betting ring, but I think increasingly it's that side of horse racing is becoming less central to the experience of the cup. And the betting ring itself and investments on racehorses through the betting ring and even through the TAB itself are perhaps, you know, less significant than some critics of gambling might like to think. Keith Dunstan, the Melbourne commentator and historian and journalist and great sort of interpreter of Melbourne life, argued in his book on sport in Australia that gambling had peaked in... Or gambling on horse racing had peaked in Australia in 1949, if you know, equaled it out on the value of the money. He did point out the fact that in the 1970s, in gambling on horses had started to go up again. But in the overall turnover and the contribution of the Melbourne Cup Carnival to the Victorian and then the Australian economy, I think it's easy to exaggerate the importance of the gambling dollar. And, of course, it's critical to racing and to the ability of clubs to give prize money and to the interests of people who own horses, who like to back them as well. But I think economically it's perhaps not as central as it may have been in certain eras in the past. So there's a sense, I think, in which the Melbourne Cup is perhaps recapturing some of the other appeals it may have had before gambling became so central to the activity. And I guess gambling probably became central to the activity in the interwar years when you got race broadcasts, telephones, and the dissemination of information through sporting newspapers in between the wars. So I think, you know, in losing the centrality of betting, racing and the Melbourne Cup Carnival and the Melbourne Cup perhaps returning to some of the character they may have had earlier in their history. So if we said that gambling's critical to it, important to it, perhaps losing an element of its centrality, what else is there that makes the Melbourne Cup significant beyond the gamble or the punt? And other people will take up this, of course, later in this session. But I think when we use this word gambling about the Melbourne Cup, and I've reduced it to the notion of betting, and I think there's a bit more to it than that. You know, the whole event has an element of a big gamble to it, going out for the big day out, talking to other people who might know about horses. Even from this moment onwards with the Liston Stakes tomorrow, and I think Shocking's starting at, I think, 60 to 1. Might be an opportunity. following that sort of meandering route of these races through to the Melbourne Cup, trying to track the form of international horses, although I think that's pretty impossible, trying to sort out how the weights might relate to victories and who's trying to win what race. I think it's that long journey towards the Melbourne Cup, and as the odds change and favouritism changes in that sort of couple of months leading up to the Cup, which is really the significance of gambling, trying to track that story. And I think that's where the Melbourne Cup is a dream rather than and betting on the Melbourne Cup becomes a dream rather than a pure financial transaction. and wandering past the bookies boards and seeing these fantastic odds for cup doubles for horses that'll actually never get a run in either the Caulfield Cup or the Melbourne Cup. And I'm sure that's got a lot to do with it. Beyond that, I think in talking about the Melbourne Cup and the way it's continued to be this central event, particularly in Melbourne life, but again in Australian life, and a lot of people have used the phrase integral to Australian culture. I think maybe we could turn to the sort of comments of a couple of historians and the notions that sort of ingrained the students of social and cultural history nowadays, that it's about the invention of a tradition. It's a tradition that always has to be keep reinventing itself as society changes and has to match that reconstruction of society. I've always wondered about the Melbourne Cup and why it's important, especially when you look at the racing people and then the people who go to the marquees and the partygoers, and you wonder how these two strands of Australian society come together at the Melbourne Cup, when about the only time they would ever pass one another would be at 4:30 in the morning when the partygoers are coming out of the nightclubs and the racing people are going off to work. So I think those two notions of an imagined community, a sense of people being a community at the track or at all of these parties all around Australia, in, you know, dressing up to the nines and trying to bet and running sweeps, you know, this sort of connection through betting is something that's really critical to its importance, and the sense that it's a tradition that can always be changing. Coming back to what other people have said about the Melbourne Cup being integral to Australian culture, in a sense that's a wonderful thing and an opportunity for horse racing, but it also makes it a prisoner of social forces that horses racing and racing people themselves can't control. And Andrew and others have mentioned this notion of egalitarianism in the handicapping of the Cup. And Les Carline's writings tend to come back to this notion that every now and then in an event like the Melbourne Cup, the battler downs the lord. The person who's struggling is able to beat the wealthiest investor in horse racing. And, you know, the classic sort of battler winning of the Cup is Bamber and his horse Revette. It's obviously much harder for these sort of people to win the Melbourne Cup now, and the internationalisation of it is a great thing and adds a lot of interest and excitement to it. It perhaps makes it more difficult for the Cup to retain that sense of egalitarianism despite the use of weights. The interest of Dermot Weld and other trainers in having the track watered on the morning of the Melbourne Cup whenever they get here might take the race a little bit further away from the battling owner and trainer. So I think that the Melbourne Cup sort of has managed to keep surviving and altering with changing interests as gambling becomes more important and as gambling becomes less important. It's always managed to be part of this invention of an alteration of tradition. It's always been central to this notion of an imagined community, and that community is expressed and is linked together and created largely through the process of gambling. That's the thing that connects everybody together. I mean, the great thing about the Melbourne Cup, to my mind, one of the great things is that it's the ordinary person who makes the favourite. It's not somebody, a professional bettor or owner who makes a horse the favourite. It's the ordinary person who bets who makes a particular horse the favourite. And a lot of the debate about the Cup is about an interest in it is this changing level of favouritism. So, yes, it is about chasing this dream, and that dream is part of Australian culture, and the challenge is for the Cup to keep transforming itself in line with changes in Australian culture. But if people are interested in betting and winning money on the Cup, I guess I come back to somebody who was quoted this morning, Damon Runyon, who said that the race doesn't always go to the fleetest of foot nor the struggle to the strongest, but that sure as hell's the way to bet. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.